KaiserNetwork.org.
Well, good morning. It is a great pleasure to welcome all of you here on behalf of the Kaiser Family Foundation. I am pleased that you're joining us in the Barbara Jordan Conference Center for a briefing on Medicaid and women looking to the future. I'm Sheila Burke. I'm the chair of the Kaiser Family Foundation's Board of Trustees and have the privilege of serving as a member of the Medicaid and Uninsured group as well. It is terrific to see all of you here today to talk with us and let us talk with you about such an extraordinarily important issue. We are here today to talk about the very unique intersection of Medicaid and women's health. As many of you who are here today know, Medicaid and women's health policy are a priority program for the Kaiser Foundation, something that we care deeply about and which we have focused our staff on and our work on for a great many years. In all of that work, our goal has always been to keep our eye on how health programs affect particularly women, those who are at greatest risk for having health problems and experiencing great difficulties in gaining access to care. Any of you who are involved in healthcare at either the national, the state, or frankly at the local level are well aware of the importance of the Medicaid program in its history all these many years. It currently serves over 50 million people nationwide and is in fact the backbone of our nation's healthcare safety net, providing healthcare, long-term care services to some of the most poor and certainly among the sickest of our population. As you will hear today, a number of the policies and the changes that have been proposed to the Medicaid program very recently, or those that are currently being implemented at the state and national level, have a particular series of issues and questions about the impact on this particular population. Some of those policies are quite far-reaching and could, in fact, have a very long-term impact on the way Medicaid is administered, how it is financed, who qualifies for services, and how and what healthcare services are available to those who are eligible. Some of the proposals have the potential to fundamentally change the program's future course. And since women comprise the vast majority of the adults on Medicaid, they will undoubtedly feel the change most dramatically. Today, we are going to talk about Medicaid's many roles for low-income women and essentially what they have at stake in the current debate. We're going to take a closer look at how Medicaid currently serves women and then discuss some of the changes being proposed and their impact. We will begin with Alina Sagonikoff, who is the Vice President and Director of the Kaiser Family Foundation's Women's Health Policy Program, who will review some of the key points about Medicaid's importance for women and present a profile of some of the women who, in fact, rely on the program today. Then we'll hear from Robin, and I'm going to mispronounce this, Rudowitz, the Principal Policy Analyst with the Kaiser Commission on Medicaid and the Uninsured, who will give us an overview of the recent changes in the Deficit Reduction Act and update us on state waiver program activity with a very particular lens and focus on what these changes might mean to women and access to care. The bios, of course, of all of our speakers today are in the folders that I hope each of you picked up on your way in. Following these presentations, we'll open it up for a discussion. As is generally the case with our programs, we'll have a panel of really terrific experts with tremendous experience with both the Medicaid program as well as with women's health concerns, and they will talk more deeply and delve into more detail on these issues, talk about the future of the Medicaid program and what some of these changes might mean for women and those who are served by the program. Jackie Judd, the Vice President and Senior Advisor for Communications here at Kaiser, will be our moderator this morning and help us go through that discussion. Our discussants before you are Rachel Gold, who is the Director of Policy Analysis for the Alan Guttmacher Institute, Judy Waxman, the Vice President for Health and Reproductive Rights at the Women's Law Center, Janet Wells, the Director of Public Policy for the National Citizens Coalition for Nursing Home Reform, and Joy Johnson-Wilson, who is the Director of Health Policy and Federal Affairs Council from the National Conference of State Legislatures and a member of Secretary Leavitt's Medicaid Commission. Let me now turn it over to our discussion. I should also note for those of you in the audience here that this event is being webcast by KaiserNetwork.org and will be available online tomorrow at www.KaiserNetwork.org. Without further ado, I'm going to turn the program over to Alina.
Thank you, Sheila. It's really great to see such a great turnout today. My colleagues here in Washington say that people really came for the yogurt parfaits. but I like to think it's because so many of you are concerned about women's health and Medicaid and really curious and been thinking as well about what the future direction of the program holds. Before I start, I would be remiss without thanking Usha Runji, my colleague in Women's Health, and our friends at Communication, Rob Graham. Our communications officer is here, and there are many people who make these wonderful events happen, and I'd like to thank them. Like childcare and family leave and welfare policy, Medicaid policy largely affects women, even though it's not often thought of as a women's program. Yet, as we're about to learn, the choices that we make at the national and state level really have the potential to profoundly affect access to care for millions of low-income women in this country. What I want to do very briefly is to review why Medicaid is such an important program for women in this nation and to give you a sense of who we are talking about when we talk about women on Medicaid, and on why having Medicaid is so important for their access to care. Let's see if I can. 1 in 10 women in this nation are covered by Medicaid. 7% of women have Medicaid alone, and another 3% have Medicaid really to serve as a wraparound to Medicare and also provide them with long-term care services. These are largely seniors or low-income women, as I said, who have disabilities. Not surprisingly, the program really takes on greater prominence for low-income women, where nearly one quarter are assisted by this program. It's important to mention that while Medicaid assists millions of low-income women, many low-income women will never qualify, no matter how poor they are, because the program has both an income and a categorical requirement. That means that unless you fit into one of its eligibility categories, either as a pregnant woman or a parent of a child that's under 18, a dependent child, or have a disability or are under 65, you will never qualify, no matter how poor you are. As you can see here, at every age, women comprise the majority of the adult Medicaid population. Overall, 70% of the adult Medicaid population is women, and we know the other half, basically half of those on Medicaid are children. Nearly three-quarters of the Medicaid population of reproductive age are women. This share falls slightly among middle-aged women, largely because of the categorical requirements, and then rises to 80% of those 85 and over. Many of those women are women who are living in nursing homes, and that's over 1 million women who are covered by Medicaid who are 85 and over. Overall, 19 million were assisted by Medicaid at some point in the year in 2003. The majority, nearly two-thirds of them, are in their reproductive years. A smaller share are between 45 and 64, and 22% are 65 or older. For these women, Medicaid pays for a broad range of services that are critically important to women of all ages. I've broken them out here by stage of life, but really many of these services, such as mental health care, care for chronic illness, disability-related care, vision and dental and rehab services, are important to women of all ages. For women in their reproductive years, Medicaid plays a critically important role. It finances over half of all publicly funded family planning. I'm sure we're going to hear more about that later in our discussion today. Medicaid is also the largest financier of pregnancy-related care in the United States, funding over one-third of all births in this nation. In some states, particularly in the South, over half of all births are paid for by Medicaid. I'm not going to go into all of these benefits, but it is worth noting that Medicaid is also our nation's only major long-term care program, financing over half of all nursing home stays and providing coverage with personal care and case management, services that are typically not covered by Medicare or private insurance. As we look to the characteristics of the Medicaid population, this slide is for women 18 to 64 and doesn't include the whole, as I said, there's 22% of women who are over 65. We see that they are a very low-income group. The majority have incomes below 200% of poverty. That's around $31,000 a year for a family of three. And half are in households with incomes below the federal poverty level, and that's 15, 15 I think, $15,500 for a family of three. While half of women on Medicaid are white, one quarter are African American, and one in five are Latinas. And among the non-elderly, two-thirds have children under 18 in the household. Women on Medicaid are also more likely to struggle with health problems. The state is from the Kaiser Women's Health Survey. One-third of non-elderly women on Medicaid report fair or poor health. Over one-quarter have arthritis or asthma, and one in 10 has diabetes. And very notable, while rates of depression are high for all women, 40% of women on Medicaid said that they had been diagnosed with depression or anxiety in the past 5 years, which is a rate twice as high as women with private coverage. There is strong evidence that shows that Medicaid improves access to care. Among non-elderly women, those on Medicaid are much less likely to experience problems accessing care compared to uninsured women. This is evident looking at a wide range of services, looking at no physician visit, no usual source of care, breast exam, or pap tests. These women get care at rates that are similar to their more affluent privately insured counterparts. Even if we look at privately insured low-income women, we actually see that the rates are almost identical to that of Medicaid. And you can see here, compared to uninsured women, that women on Medicaid do much better. But having coverage is not enough to assure access to care. And it must be acknowledged that Medicaid has had some long-standing problems getting private doctors and specialists to participate in the program. This is largely because of the historically low payment rates that Medicaid has had compared to private insurance. We see here that how that plays out in terms of access and why it must be acknowledged that Medicaid, that women on Medicaid say that Well, it must be acknowledged that while Medicaid is trying, that there's still some programs to some issues really to fix. We see one quarter of women on Medicaid said that they tried to see a new doctor, but the doctor wasn't accepting new patients, and 28% said that they were not able to see a specialist when they thought that the care was needed. This is actually twice the rate of those with private insurance. And because so many women on Medicaid are economically disadvantaged, costs can really be a barrier to care for a sizable share of women on Medicaid. One-third said that they delayed care because the care they thought they needed because of costs, and nearly one in five didn't fill a prescription because of cost. This is still better than the rates for uninsured women, but a real problem nonetheless. When this survey was conducted, Medicaid either had no or nominal cost-sharing requirements, and cost was still a barrier, as you can see. As we're going to hear more, that may even change now under the Deficit Reduction Act, and this will likely have sizable implications for women who are enrolled in the program. An issue that gets less attention, but that's critically important, is the role that Medicaid plays financing long-term care. 37% of all Medicaid spending goes towards long-term care. This includes nursing home care, care for the mentally retarded, home and community-based care, and institutional care for the mentally ill. And finally, given women's relatively long lifespans, high levels of chronic conditions, older women are the primary users of long-term care services in the U.S. And they account for three-quarters of nursing home residents and two-thirds of those who receive home health services. The cost of long-term care services, as you know, can be quite burdensome for women and their families. A year of nursing home care can cost upwards of $75,000, and hiring a home health aide could easily cost upwards of $12,000 a year. As a result of the many long-term care changes in the Deficit Reduction Act relating to nursing home eligibility and home and community-based care that you're going to hear about, many of these changes may directly impact many women. I'm going to turn now to Robin Rudowitz, who's going to walk you through some of the changes that are being considered under the Deficit Reduction Act and also by ongoing state waiver activity in the Medicaid program. Thanks, Robin.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for coming, especially as the rain is starting to come down. I know it's an extra effort to come to a morning briefing. Thanks, Alina, for that great overview of Medicaid's role for women. And as discussed, my role in the next few minutes is to describe recent changes included in the Deficit Reduction Act and changes that states are pursuing through Medicaid waivers. Before I started with those describing those changes, I wanted to just provide one slide of context to show sort of how we got here and what's going on in the larger picture and why Medicaid is currently at the center of many state and federal budget and policy debates. First of all, as we all know, there are many pressures facing the overall healthcare system. Healthcare costs are rising. This is happening in both the private and public sectors. There's been a continued erosion in employer-sponsored coverage, resulting in an increasing number of uninsured people. And there's also changing demographics, particularly the aging population, that's putting more pressure on the overall healthcare system. There's also been a series of pressures at the state level. Beginning in 2001, there was a severe economic downturn where state revenues plummeted. At the same time, Medicaid spending increased, mostly due to increasing enrollment. Now state revenues are starting to recover, but Medicaid spending growth is still growing faster than state revenues. There's been an intense focus over the last few years on states focusing on efforts to control Medicaid costs. And there's also now been a focus on turning towards these waivers to look at new ways to control costs. There's also been a number of pressures at the federal level. Those include the growing federal deficit and pressures to reduce that deficit at the same time to extend the tax cuts. And there's also been a focus on controlling Medicaid spending growth. The Deficit Reduction Act passed or signed in February included major savings from the Medicaid program. The president's budget that was also released in February, the proposal for 2007, included additional changes or proposals to reduce Medicaid spending, and the Secretary's Federal Commission is expected to reduce additional recommendations at the end of this fiscal year, or the end of this calendar year. So now we can turn to some of the changes that were included in the Deficit Reduction Act. These changes are expected to generate about $12 billion in savings over the next 5 years and over $43 billion in savings over the next 10 years. These are federal gross savings coming from the Medicaid program. This chart shows the distribution of those savings in these four major categories. It's important to note in this slide that the provisions related to benefits and cost sharing represent a larger share of the savings over the 10-year period, and these are the provisions that will most likely have the most profound impact on beneficiaries. These provisions, along with changes to documentation requirements and the long-term care changes, will be also the provisions that are most likely to affect women, and they'll be the focus of the next few slides. The DRA included provisions that give states more and new flexibility around benefits and cost sharing. The new law allows states to impose cost sharing for new beneficiaries who were previously exempt and also impose higher cost sharing for beneficiaries that were also already able to have cost sharing applied to them, and also allows states to apply premiums to beneficiaries above 150% of the federal poverty level. The other change related to cost sharing is that states are now allowed to make these cost-sharing requirements enforceable, which means that providers or pharmacists can now deny services or drugs at the point of service if beneficiaries can't pay their copays. We just heard from Alina that a third of women on Medicaid had delayed needed care because of costs, and again, these provisions are likely to exacerbate that situation. The DRA also included provisions that allow states to replace the current Medicaid benefits package with new benchmark plans for beneficiaries. These benchmark plans are like those that are included in the state Children's Health Insurance Program. And they include plans that would look like a Blue Cross Blue Shield plan for federal employees, or a plan offered by the largest managed care organization in the state, or plans that are offered to state employees. And another category, states can apply for secretary-approved coverage, and this allows states a great deal of flexibility in designing these new benefit packages. Key services for women, such as family planning, mental health services, and also rehabilitation services, could be excluded from these new benchmark plans. There are some beneficiaries who would be exempt from these new benefit limits, including individuals with disabilities or those who need long-term care services. However, according to the guidance, the states are allowed to enroll these populations on a voluntary basis. The law does require states to continue to provide EPSDT services for children, so it does maintain broad and comprehensive coverage for children. The law also allows variation in benefits and cost sharing across groups and across geographic areas. Under current law, when states provide services or impose cost sharing, it needs to be the same for all beneficiaries across the entire state. The DRA also has a new important provision that requires all new and current Medicaid enrollees to provide documentation to prove their citizenship status to obtain or retain Medicaid coverage. The main sources of this documentation include a U.S. passport or a birth certificate. In the law, the Secretary of HHS is given authority to allow for alternative documentation. However, this guidance has not been released yet, and this provision takes or goes into effect in the 1st of July. Currently, 47 states allow beneficiaries applying to Medicaid to self-declare their citizenship status, so this is a major change for many states. The provision will impose new administrative burdens for states in determining eligibility and also impose new barriers for individuals applying for the program. Many states over the last several years have been working to simplify their eligibility processes, and this moves really in the opposite direction. There's a wide range of estimates about how many people will be or will lose coverage as a result of this provision, and it largely depends on how the provision is implemented. There are a number of provisions in the Deficit Reduction Act that change the asset transfer rules around how Medicaid determines eligibility for nursing home services. These provisions are likely to generate about $6.5 billion in savings from the program over the next 10 years. The biggest changes in this area are related to the change in the penalty period for making these asset transfers from the time of when the asset is transferred to the time of Medicaid eligibility. Also in these provisions is a change in how far states are required to look back to see when transfers were made. Currently, they need to look back 3 years, and now they're going to need to look back 5 years to see if any transfers were made during that time. The Congressional Budget Office estimates that these provisions will result in a delay in nursing home eligibility for about 130,000 people annually. That's about 15% of the new Medicaid nursing home residents each year. And again, since we know that women represent 3/4 of all nursing home residents, this provision will have a disproportionate effect on women. The Deficit Reduction Act also included some provisions that will increase spending. The largest piece of new spending was $2 billion that was provided to provide relief from Hurricane Katrina. But the next largest bulk of spending was related to long-term care services. The biggest piece of this new spending is related to the Family Opportunities Act. Under this provision, states have the option to allow parents with incomes of about $300,000 to buy into the Medicaid program for their disabled children. While the provision targets children, it's important to note that this provision recognizes that there are very limited options in the private sector for persons with disabilities to get adequate coverage. These provisions also include the next three bars up are all related to expanding access to community long-term care services. And again, we know that women are the largest majority of community long-term care users. They're also the largest or primary caregivers. So to have additional supports and access to community long-term care services will also have a disproportionate benefit to women. And finally, the top tiny bar shows that there is some additional funding included in the DRA to expand the long-term care partnership programs. They've been currently operating in 4 states, and this will provide additional access to long-term care insurance products. as all these changes are taking place in the DRA and through waivers, there are four major themes that are emerging. One is an emphasis on personal behavior and personal responsibility. The second is this targeting or tailoring of benefits for different populations. The third is an increased role of the private marketplace. And lastly is an effort to restrict spending or efforts to increase the predictability of spending going forward. There are three examples that I'm going to provide, and there's a lot more information about these or two of these examples on the table outside. But Florida has a Medicaid waiver that was approved last October, and it's about to be implemented in two counties starting in July. The Florida waiver incorporates many of the features that are listed on this page. The waiver moves toward a defined contribution plan where the state will allot a risk-adjusted premium or a certain set amount of money to beneficiaries who will then choose their plan in the private sector. And these plans will have more control over what the benefits will be available to these beneficiaries. The Florida waiver also has a provision that would allow beneficiaries access to an enhanced set of benefits if they engage in healthy activities. So this is an example of incentives to provide changes in behavior. Kentucky is an example of a state that just submitted and was approved their a plan to change their Medicaid program using the current flexibility now available under the Deficit Reduction Act. Kentucky's focus of their plan, called Kentucky Health Choices, will group beneficiaries into four major groups and then tailor or adjust the benefits available to each of these separate groups. The Kentucky plan also incorporates additional cost sharing for these beneficiaries. And finally, Vermont is an example of a state that through a Medicaid waiver is the first and only state in the country that now has an aggregate cap on their federal Medicaid financing. So that's an example of the last major trend or theme that we're seeing. All of these changes, whoops. Ooh, I don't know if I could
go back.
I can't go back. everyone has the slides. All these changes are taking place and will continue to take place. More states are going to be pursuing waivers, and we will have to wait and see how many states take up the options that are available to them under the DRA. Several really critical issues emerge, and we'll want to keep track of and follow. The first is, what do these changes really mean for the availability and affordability of coverage for women on the Medicaid program? Second is, how is the fiscal responsibility and risk for the program shifting between the federal government, plans, the states, and beneficiaries? Will the variations in coverage for women within states and across states get bigger? And what's the right balance between allowing states flexibility to administer their programs, yet having federal standards for the program? And finally, are these changes occurring with enough evaluation and transparency and accountability so people know what's going on and could keep track of these things? So that was a lot of information I think I just went through very quickly. And I am excited to hear from the panel and happy to answer any questions. Thanks.
Thank you, Robin. Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us today. Joy, I'd like to start the questioning with you before we open it up to the audience in about 20 minutes or so. Robin gave us a sense of what's happening in three states. Can you give us the bigger picture of what policy initiatives seem to be gaining most momentum as a result of the provisions under the Deficit Reduction Act?
Well, I think it's a little early to say what's going to happen with the flexibility that's provided in deficit reduction. I think in terms of looking at what states are looking at, simplification of eligibility is something that states are looking at, and that's reflected in, say, the Kentucky and West Virginia DRA, where they've honed the categories down to four. There is a reemergence of managed care. I think states are reevaluating. When they started out, they carved out mental health and people with disabilities. where we spend the most money and where the most management is most helpful, and I think they're reevaluating that. So more states are looking at providing managed and coordinated care for people with chronic illness, disability, and mental illness, and with support from those communities, which I think is important. We clearly have a financial issue, a challenge that continues, and we have limited flexibility in how we deal with that. That will continue. But I think that there's much more emphasis on effective, trying to find effective approaches to increase the effectiveness of the health that we're providing to our Medicaid clients. And I think that if anything, I hear much more of that discussion among legislators, that they want to get more bang for their buck. They want some evaluation of programs. They want to see what's working. And they go to other states to see if there's a program that's working that they can replicate. So I think those are some themes. I think the other thing that you've probably read about in your newspapers is that they're starting to look at who else is providing health care in the state and how that's all and what impact that has on Medicaid. You hear about the Walmart bills, but it's not just Walmart. And it's the employer-based system is not holding up its share, and we should all be very concerned about that. I think the other thing that we're concerned about is erosion of private coverage in terms of what actually is covered. And that there is a recognition that we're starting to see Medicaid and private insurance kind of collide in this interesting way where I used to call Medicaid the Cinderella of healthcare programs. Anything somebody else wouldn't do, Medicaid came in with the broom, swept it up, and did that work. No Prince Charming, no car, you know, no pretty dress, none of that. But now I'm saying Medicaid is more like the girl from the wrong side of the tracks. Nobody wanted to date Medicaid back when. You know, she looked kind of pretty, had a lot of bells and whistles, good shape, but now, wrong side. Now you have people fighting to get on Medicaid, wanting to date her. She has, her dance card is full, which has some...
These analogies could only work in a room full of women, you understand.
Interesting suggestion for healthcare policy, I think.
Okay. I want to just backtrack for a minute and go back to Robin. We've heard about states creating categories, three or four categories to put people into. What are the standards used?
Well, in Kentucky, there are four categories. I think there are children and adults, elderly and disabled, and then there's a separate category for individuals with mental retardation issues.
Judy, I want to jump down to you. You mentioned before the event began, and Joy touched on it briefly, what West Virginia recently did. Can you turn your mic on?
Certainly. That sounds better. Yeah. Joy mentioned, too, that Kentucky and also West Virginia were the first states to have new plans, particularly benefit plans, approved under the DRA. And unfortunately, at least I have to say Kentucky's a little hard to understand, but West Virginia is kind of what we feared the most. As Robin said, that the benchmark plans that are offered are, there's different ways the state could go. One way is just a secretary-approved plan, whatever that is. And in the case of West Virginia, that's the category they pick. So there's no particular standards. It's just what the secretary approves. And, of course, that would be our worst fear, that every state would go that way. And what West Virginia did, I'll just talk about the adults, although kids are included as well. Let me also digress for a second. When we talk about adults, we are talking about pregnant women, too, and they are often excluded from this. So I should make the point first that looking again at the slides, that 11% of the expenses of acute care is for adults of the entire program, and a big chunk of that is pregnant women. So when you're talking about just the healthy adults or the parent adults, that is really a small part of the Medicaid pie, and yet there's a lot of focus on that particular group. Obviously, you're not going to be able to save that much money because there's not that much money there in the first place. So that is a preference. What West Virginia did is set up a new kind of plan where, fitting with the themes of personal responsibility and also targeted benefits, they now will have a basic plan and enhanced plan. Every adult and child, but we'll talk about the adult plans, gets a basic plan, and then they go into their provider and have to sign a pledge. And some of the provisions of the pledge are not quite that clear. I'll do my best to stay healthy, and I will go to health improvement programs as directed by my, they call it medical home. Don't exactly know what a health improvement program is, but there are other things that I will take my children to the doctor, I will be on time, I will take my medications and so forth. And the medical home, or presumably their primary care provider, has to have them sign this, and if they break any of these rules, if they sign it, they get this enhanced package. If they don't, if they break it, and I think it's the provider reporting them, I guess to the state. I mean, this is all not all that clear. Then they get bumped down to the basic plan. And for a year, well, they can appeal, or for a year, or then they could try to be good again and get the enhanced plan. And the interesting thing is that, of course, just a couple examples, prescriptions in the basic plan are limited to 4 a month, but they're not limited in the enhanced plan. But another two interesting benefits in the enhanced plan is mental health services and diabetes care. So if somehow you don't follow the health improvement plan, whatever that is, then you would lose your diabetes care or your mental health services probably for a year. Without belaboring it, you get my point, I think, that this is kind of scary, and it is just picking the secretary-approved plan, and it's what we feared the most. And right out of the bag, that's what happened.
Rachel, when you hear about a plan like that or the other kinds of changes that have been discussed, what concerns you the most for the young people who you represent?
Well, I think, you know, in 1972, Congress went into the Medicaid statute and said that all Medicaid recipients have an entitlement to family planning services. And what the Deficit Reduction Act really has done is to remove that entitlement for at least some Medicaid enrollees. For me, it's most distressing that this is happening right at the time when there's really incredibly distressing new data coming out about contraceptive use and unintended pregnancy among low-income women in our country. We know that disparities between more affluent women and lower-income women in contraceptive use are growing. For decades, the differences had been narrowing, and they're now starting to grow again. And contraceptive use among low-income women is falling. It's not surprising, therefore, that unintended pregnancy among low-income women is rising. But the numbers are really just absolutely shocking. From 1995 to 2001, unintended pregnancy among low-income women rose by 30%. At the same time, unintended pregnancy for more affluent women fell by 20%. Clearly, something's going on. We now have a situation in our country where low-income women are 4 times as likely to face an unintended pregnancy as are more affluent women. It is therefore no surprise, you know, one of the big results of unintended pregnancy, as we all know, is abortion. It's therefore no surprise at all that low-income women are more than 4 times as likely as a more affluent woman to have an abortion in this country. This is absolutely no time, I would argue, for states or anyone to be considering to rolling back our commitment to publicly funded family planning. These are services that are critically needed at this moment in time. And I think it's most unfortunate that for the first time in 30 years, this is on the table now for Medicaid recipients.
Janet, you kind of represent the other end of the age spectrum. What do you see in recent moves in the states that most concerns you with long-term care? I don't think the mic is on.
Is it on now?
Yeah. Is it?
Okay. I think we deal more on the quality side of long-term care than we do on the financing side. And I think our concern has always been is that when you see these changes in Medicaid, the discussion of flexibility, block grants, that what you see is a lessening of regulation. So often with proposals for block grants at the federal level, there has been an elimination of the quality standards in Medicaid. And I think that's a very important thing to understand about Medicaid for nursing home care is that Medicaid does set the quality standards for nursing home care for people both who are on Medicaid and people who are not. The nursing home reform law of 1987 has become the minimum quality standard for nursing home care throughout the country and affects private pay, people in private pay nursing homes, as well as those on Medicaid. It's extremely important. So we often see a lessening of regulation under these flexibility plans, and we have a lot of concern about people going into home and community-based services where there is not attention to regulation. Assisted living is very poorly regulated in many states. The federal government has not wanted to move in the direction of providing more quality direction to home and community-based services. So we're just very concerned about what kind of quality women will be getting in these new home-based services.
Robin talked in her presentation about the change in the asset transfers from 3 years to 5 years and that affecting, I think you said, 130,000 people going into long-term care a year. What alternatives are there? Is it the community homes you were just discussing?
We're afraid that it is, and I think for one thing we talk now about personal responsibility. Under the asset transfer provisions, a woman could easily have spent $250,000 if she had it on long-term care, then get to a point within 5 years where she has nothing left. And we see these cases. They would look back, see that she had given away some money in that, you know, in those early years before she needed long-term care and began to pay for long-term care, and she could be denied Medicaid, have no resources left, and be thrown out. And I think in a lot of these scenarios we've seen where states like Kentucky a couple of years ago changed its eligibility criteria for Medicaid, and you had elderly women in their 80s and 90s, suddenly told, you no longer have any resources to stay in this facility. And we have to realize that really happens. We really hear of people being transitioned from nursing homes into homeless shelters.
One of the themes that we've heard about this morning from several of our speakers is personal responsibility and how that's emerging as a major theme in Medicaid. And I'm wondering, what is the parallel responsibility that states are saying they must assume? What is the parallel thought to personal responsibility for the individual recipients? I'm not quite sure who wants to take that. Go ahead.
I'd just like to address one aspect of personal responsibility, and that's long-term care insurance. We're a huge drive to tell people you have to take that responsibility yourself and provide for your care by paying quite a bit of money for long-term care insurance, perhaps throughout your life. We had a briefing in the Senate a couple of weeks ago with around a publication we've done on abuse and neglect in nursing homes, and one of the speakers was a woman whose father had died from neglect in a California nursing home. And while he was being neglected and dying, his private insurance policy was paying for that care. I think there's a strong responsibility that if we're going to put more responsibility onto people to pay for care, we also have to have better quality for everybody.
Alina, do you want to take that on?
I think that there's a lot, we're seeing a move more towards a kind of a defined contribution where the state is actually saying, we're going to give you this set amount of money. You can go to the private sector and buy something. So there's, I think, more of the movement to say, this is kind of what we are willing to pay for. And as a consumer, you should go out to the marketplace. We're seeing it in the private sector as well. It's the kind of the same movement. And I think it's largely untested in the private sector and even more untested, I think, in the Medicaid program.
Joy, what in the private sector can easily, if that's the word, apply to Medicaid?
Well, I think that's the problem, that there are some things in Medicaid that the private sector could look at. There's some things in the private sector that Medicaid could look at. But fundamentally, we're changing how we're viewing health insurance coverage. and that's without a plan, so that this personal responsibility without education is non-functional. We're not doing very much on the education side of health. We're not doing much on health literacy, but we're now asking people to be health literate. And I don't think that works in private insurance, and I don't think it works in Medicaid, and without the underpinning education, which we're not doing. So, you know, I think that personal responsibility, who can be against that? But what does that mean, and how do you get people ready to be responsible? I think we've not addressed. You know, I think the other important difference between Medicaid and private insurance is that Medicaid provides services that private insurance does not provide, such as transportation to appointments, and they're just other things that you need to provide to people that have special needs and circumstances that is not addressed in private insurance. And in some ways, that's why having states be able to do specialized product for individual categories of people is important. So it's not all bad. And it might not be bad if private insurance did some of those things as well. But since they're getting rid of some of the things that Medicaid is now covering in terms of services, that seems unlikely. But I think that's part of the issue, the convergence not only of product, but of the people who qualify. So that you have people of same income, one on Medicaid, one in private insurance, and it used to be they were trying to date the private insurance person, but now they're trying to get on Medicaid because the benefits are better. This is, so I would say that maybe instead of purely concentrating on the public program, we need to put a little more pressure on the private side to make sure that there's this balance because, you know, when your dance card gets full, there are not enough days in the week to date everybody. And, you know, dating's not such a big problem, but when you're Medicaid and you can't take the next client, that is a problem. And so I think we're getting to that point where Medicaid cannot subsume a lot more people on the acute care side when we know we are going to take pretty much everyone on the long-term care side. And so I think that's a challenge that we have.
You said in there something really important. It's not all bad, and it's something that we should also discuss. Rachel, I would turn to you and say, what positive changes do you see?
Well, I think in Medicaid in general, there have been a lot of positive things happening in the world of family planning over the last decade or so. Several states have taken the initiative to go to the feds and ask essentially for federal permission through a waiver to expand eligibility for Medicaid-covered family planning services. We now have about 23 states that have received federal approval to expand their coverage. And in many cases, those programs provide Medicaid coverage for all women in the state with an income up to 200% of poverty. And when you look at these programs that now, you know, in some cases we have almost a decade's worth of data and information on these programs, you see that the results are really shocking, that the feds require these programs to be what's called budget neutral. In other words, they can't cost the feds more than the feds would have spent in the absence of the program. And all of these states that have adopted these programs have not only met that budget neutrality requirement, but in fact have blown right through it and have saved, you know, enormous sums of money. We're talking about $20 million a year in states the size of Arkansas, Alabama, South Carolina, not, you know, huge states. And those savings come from, you know, enabling women to avoid unintended pregnancies that would have resulted in Medicaid-funded deliveries. So I think there's, you know, a model out there for us to look at and to say, if, you know, in fact, if you want to cut Medicaid costs, you know, the bill was called the Deficit Reduction Act. If you want to cut Medicaid-covered costs, you don't cut back on family planning. You, in fact, encourage states and make it easier for states to expand family planning. Not only does the expansion, you know, save money, but it also, by reducing unintended pregnancy, it reduces the need for abortion. So I think, you know, there are those kinds of encouraging models out there, and some places that states that are, frankly, you know, considering cutting back on their programs might want to look at this experience and come to the same conclusion that, you know, that maybe we want to expand it rather than cut it.
Before we open it up to the audience, Judy, I'd like you to take that same question.
Well, I wanted
Mike, please.
Oh,
I wanted to go with Joy's analogy just a little bit to say that while obviously we all sympathize with rising costs in Medicaid, in the private sector, everywhere on rising healthcare costs, that really is the bigger problem that we haven't yet grappled with as a nation. It's not really, the problem for Medicaid or an individual employer. But in terms of Joy's analogy, one of the things that many of us here have continued to fight for is that that dance card really does not close down. That dance card stays open. Medicaid's an entitlement. And I recognize the strain it puts on the state, but it is an extremely important feature of the program that if somebody does meet the eligibility level, they do get to dance. And we have to continue to make sure that that is how the program continues to operate, which, of course, then brings up the problem of, you know, what are they, who are they going to dance with? Maybe I ought to say it that way. Or how is that going to work, which is what we're all really dealing with here. I forget what the original question was. Why don't I just stop there?
Well, what I was playing off of was what Joy was saying in the middle of her dance card analogy was there are some positive, not everything is bad, not everything is wrong, and if you see things in some of these models that are emerging from the states as encouraging.
Well, maybe the Family Opportunity Act might get more people some services that they would need. I would look at that as a positive, potentially positive feature of this particular bill. That's the one that comes to mind.
And Jackie, I would just say, too, on the positive side for older women, that to have an option not to go into a nursing home to be able to get long-term care somewhere else is very important, and people have really fought for that. Right now, under Medicaid in most states, if you need long-term care and you can't afford to pay for it, Medicaid will send you to a nursing home. And
good. Thank you. Who in the audience would like to ask the first question? And when you do, if you could stand, identify yourself and your affiliation, I'd appreciate it. Raise your hand. Over here.
I'm Lindsay Morris Barron with the March of Dimes. As more and more states are considering moving towards a defined contribution model, one of the things that we're really concerned about is that these seem to be states that don't have maternity coverage mandates in the individual market. So we're talking about women who are already pregnant shopping around for coverage in markets where plans may or probably not have experience offering maternity services to these women. And so one of the things that we are trying to kind of wrap our heads around practically is how to empower our advocates on the ground for how to make sure that, you know, women, particularly high-risk women who may have HIV or diabetes or hypertension, who are pregnant and will need truly comprehensive maternity care, are going to be able to access those services through plans that have probably never done this before. I'm wondering if y'all could speak to, or somebody could speak to, you know, how do we talk to our advocates about, you know, being on guard for that and making sure that women, because it's going to be a lot harder to track now that women are going to be funneled into all different plans and assuming that they can even find coverage that will accept them. What can our advocates do to make sure that women are still served?
Alina?
Well, I think in the individual market, there are going to be very few options for those women, usually, unless you have already purchased. I think a lot of them have a rider, and you have to have it for at least a year. So unless you've already purchased your individual coverage, the individual market is really not going to be an option for you, and in some cases, the plans don't really even offer the opportunity to purchase a rider and have maternity care. And I think in terms of kind of women who are on Medicaid, because I think that's the other issue is, I mean, I think that's a really valid concern. I know that I remember back when we first started kind of looking at the kind of managed care, and a lot of states were adopting it, people were really worried about what was going to happen in the, you know, in terms of managed care plans, in terms of their abilities to care for really this very high risk, in many cases, Medicaid population. And the results were really mixed. Some plans, as always, some plans really were very prepared and had a lot of good assessment tools that they used up front to really do a very good job with high-risk women. And other plans really fell short. So I think it's really a matter of kind of vigilance and monitoring. But I think really looking at the individual market, I think that that's, I mean, it's not there generally for people who are very sick. And if you're looking at high-risk pregnant women, they're, you know, I know the March of Dimes is very interested in preventing preterm birth, and we know that that is one of the most expensive conditions, really, for the system to deal with.
Joy?
In the states that are moving in that direction, most of them require some sort of pre-counseling, and I think that's where advocates have an opportunity to weigh in terms of how that pre-counseling is done. It is not in the interest of the state, in terms of their Medicaid program, to allow high-risk women to go without care or to have inadequate care, because ultimately that will be an increased cost to the state. So I don't think that there's any incentive for states to make that happen. But I think the question then is, how on the front end is the counseling done to help make sure that those women get into the plans that can provide adequate care for them during the pregnancy and after? And I think that's where advocates should be talking with the state Medicaid people about how they're going to get that done and what you all can do to help them in that way.
I just want to add one more thing. A lot of times, you know, we talk about how pregnant women are carved out, and I think some of us give of these a lot of these requirements, and I think some of us feel, oh, well, there's security, at least that group is protected. But we're talking about 19 million women on Medicaid, and Medicaid pays for about 1.5 million births a year. So that there's a lot of women who are probably going to be at some point exposed to a program or a benefit plan that may not cover their needs or be able to address their particular conditions.
Judy.
Yeah, I was just going to add that maybe this is obvious, but talking to the state up front, too, to make sure that there are plans available that will know how to take care of these various problems. And, of course, trying to figure out a system to make sure that women can get into the right plan, but you do have to make sure the plans exist that can deal with it.
Rachel, did you want to get in on that?
I just, you know, when it comes to these defined contribution plans or some of these kinds of plans, I worry a lot, not just about pregnant women, but about preventive care in general, which I think is kind of almost an overarching kind of issue, that if you're in a position where, you know, you have a defined pot of money that you're working with for your health care or your family's health care for the year, I think there's a very natural incentive to kind of perhaps forego some of the really important preventive services in order to almost save up for the acute care. And I worry that we're kind of reversing a couple of decades of progress in providing preventive health care and encouraging people to obtain the preventive health care that they need, which isn't frankly going to serve, you know, the women out there, and it's not going to serve the state, you know, at the end of the day when the acute care becomes, you know, more necessary and more expensive. So I just worry about the strange incentives in some of these plans.
Sorry, I just thought of adding one other thing is at this point, Florida is the only one I think that we have for sure that has this moving towards this in only two counties, defined contribution, and then we'll see what happens with that. So I just want to caution about assuming that this is the way the program is going and kind of accepting that as the way it is. I think the other thing you should tell your advocates, and everyone should, is when these things come up in other states, that there's a lot advocates could say about what they fear from defined contribution plans. And maybe there's some work we could do from the get-go to make sure that this is not a trend.
Is there a question on this side of the audience? Yes, in the back.
Hi, my name is Sarah Grams. I'm from the Family Planning Council in Philadelphia, and this might be my paranoia, but I wonder if there's a firewall between, when you talk about personal responsibility, there's a firewall between Medicaid and the Bush administration's attack on birth control and their ludicrous funding of abstinence-only education. Because if that firewall isn't there, I wonder what personal responsibility means for family planning in the future of Medicaid.
Rachel?
You know, I think the short answer is no, I'm not so sure there's a firewall, much of a firewall there. I think, you know, any state that looks at the facts and the figures and the data and the statistics in deciding whether to cover family planning or not cover family planning or to cut back on it, whatever, you know, it has to come to the conclusion that the logical, that it makes sense. The only logical conclusion is to include coverage of family planning services. Having said, you know, whether it's on cost ground, whether it's on, you know, even, the, you know, the standard definition of personal responsibility, there is, you know, by definition, personal responsibility is using contraceptive services when you need them, accessing family planning when you need them, when you need those services, getting treatment for an STD when you need it rather than going untreated and perhaps spreading the disease. You know, that's, you know, a pretty textbook definition of the term personal responsibility. I think it has to be said, however, that this is, you know, when it comes to reproductive health, not all decisions are made based on the facts and the figures, you know, you know, puts a chill in the heart of my organization, which is such a, you know, data and statistics kind of place, but not all decisions when it comes to reproductive health care are made on the, you know, rationally on the facts and the figures, and there are political considerations always that come into play. And I think what some of, you know, these changes in the Deficit Reduction Act have done is to put these issues on the table that have simply not been on the table for decades and decades, and to make these issues of coverage and cost of family planning services, for example, you know, political issues out there in the states when they just haven't been, you know, able to be on the table for decades and could result in some significant political controversy. Joy.
And I just think it's important to note that a lot of these decisions have to be made at the state level, and my observation is that decisions that are being made for women on private health insurance aren't so much different, and in fact maybe are more severe than what's available in Medicaid, so that there's a lot of work to be done at the state and local level in terms of the direction of policy related to reproductive health, and that it's not so much what the Bush administration is doing, it's all the administrations below that that also are important in terms of making policy in this area. And I just urge you to pay attention to what's going on at the state level and in local levels as well in terms of policy on reproductive health, whether that's morning after pill or whether you can get it over the counter. I mean, there's a lot of issues that are coming up now that have not been discussed in some time, and the policies are different from state to state, and so for those of you who are working in the trenches, there's a lot of work to be done there.
Judy?
Yeah, I just want to get back to the question about this Bush administration. And in fact, as Rachel said, 23 states have been approved to be able to expand distributing family planning services to women whose income are above the Medicaid eligibility level. And we were certainly concerned that this administration would not continue to approve those, but in fact it has. So a number have been approved in the last few years, and there's a few more pending, which we do expect to be approved eventually. So in terms of this administration's stance on family planning, yes, there's much to be concerned about, but at least in terms of recognizing that it does make sense to provide family planning services to women, let's say, who would be eligible for pregnancy care but are not eligible for regular Medicaid, to at least provide them with family planning services is a growing recognition in the states, and this administration is agreeing with that in many cases as well.
And just to kind of go back to Joy's point, many of these decisions are going to be made, again, at the state level in terms of what will actually play out in terms of Medicaid family planning coverage and the plans, but that will be at the state.
I want to go back to an issue, a different issue that we touched on lightly before, and that is the challenge of finding enough private providers who will look after Medicaid patients. With some of the new models that we're hearing about emerging from the states, how does that dynamic get changed? How is it affected? Who wants to take that? Alina? And then Rachel.
This has been an issue that I've always been really interested in. Again, harkening back to the early days of Medicaid managed care, I think a lot of states were thinking that with the managed care plans, that a lot of the provider participation problems would be largely erased. Yet we're still finding, I think, that that women are having trouble finding private doctors, finding specialists, so that, you know, that's one of the issues that I think hasn't been addressed. And I think that, you know, I come from California, and we have very, very low payment rates for physicians. And I think in the interest of trying to save money, often provider reimbursement rates are often the first to go. And I don't think there's really been any discussion about how we can get more providers into the pool, unless I'm missing something.
Rachel?
Yeah, in several of these, you know, state Medicaid eligibility expansions, there has been an enormous push on the part, actually, of the state to expand the participation of private doctors in these programs. And we've seen a fair amount of success. Actually, the biggest success is in California, where they've really worked very hard with the provider community. But I think Alina is right that, you know, the biggest impediment that California has found and other states have found when they've gone out there are the very low reimbursement rates, and those rates are very low not only on the private doc side, but also, you know, for the public providers as well. And we're seeing increasingly that the reimbursement rates don't even cover the cost of providing the services, so that you find other sources of funding needed. You have to find other sources of funding needed to subsidize even the cost of your Medicaid clients, which is clearly a disincentive for private docs, but, you know, a problem for the clinic population as well.
Judy, and then we'll go back to the audience.
Okay, I just want to go back to West Virginia, because if states are, more states are planning this kind of thing that puts the provider in the role of police officer and have to monitor their patients and then report them for bad behavior, and then the person loses reimbursement, I don't see more providers wanting to participate in a program like that. My guess is it might go the other way. That's all.
Does West Virginia, by the way, address the issue of doctor-patient confidentiality?
Not in the document that we've seen. That's a very interesting question.
Okay. There are some questions up here. The lady in blue.
Thank you. I'm Susan Garfield, Boston University School of Public Health. Being from Massachusetts, I'm going to ask a question about coverage expansion. There's been some great comments on coverage for pregnancy, but as we all know, a lot of that coverage evaporates usually right after the birth or six weeks after. I'm looking at a concept of internatal care and wanted to know your thoughts about any opportunities to address some of the downstream sequelae for pregnancy and their impact on the next birth outcome. We heard from March of Dimes, et cetera. So,
Rachel.
You know, I've talked a lot this morning, I guess, about these Medicaid expansions for family planning. This whole movement really started with a couple of states realizing that maybe, you know, that 60 days after delivery, you know, absent anything else happening, the baby would stay on Medicaid, and the woman was pretty unceremoniously, you know, just pushed off the cliff, you know, bye, have a nice life. And a couple of states realized that maybe that wasn't really the wisest public policy here and maybe not where we wanted to go. And some states, starting with Rhode Island and South Carolina, moved to provide 2 years of family planning coverage for a woman after a Medicaid-funded delivery. And those programs are now almost a decade old, and, you know, again, the data coming out are pretty astonishing. You look at numbers in Rhode Island, where they've tracked what they call short interbirth interval, which is when the woman gets pregnant again within 9 months of a previous delivery. And there was a big historic gap between low-income, between Medicaid-eligible women and privately insured women, with Medicaid-eligible women much more likely to have children very close together, which is a, you know, a well-acknowledged, I saw someone from the March of Dimes here, a widely acknowledged risk factor for infant mortality. So it's an important variable to make some headway on. And in Rhode Island, what they've done is to track the percent of women, Medicaid-eligible women who have a short interbirth interval, and the percent of privately insured women with a short interbirth interval. And they saw within 1 year of implementing this program, that gap, which was a longstanding historical gap, completely disappeared. And those two lines on the graph virtually converged. So it's, you know, an incredible example of, you know, sometimes you enact a policy and it does just what you wanted it to do. But I think, you know, we can learn a lot by looking at those programs and paying attention. While, you know, we absolutely need to pay attention to women before pregnancy and during pregnancy, I think we have to pay attention to women after pregnancy as well.
Alina.
I just wanted to mention that the CDC, actually, I think it's in the last week's Morbidity and Mortality Report, has brought together a large panel of experts, a consensus panel, to look at interconception care. And actually, one of their recommendations was that women should have insurance coverage so that they have access to care. And so I think that it is, I mean, and usually one expects many of these findings from CDC to have a really clinical orientation. And so this was really a very important policy recommendation for this group as well.
Yes.
Thank you. My name is Deborah Lipson. I'm with Mathematica Policy Research. It's good to see so many of you here. I'm struck by this conversation we're having about personal responsibility. It sort of brings to mind, was it Margaret Atwood's Handmaiden's Tale? You know, there's some very strange echoes here. But it seems to me that it's completely happening in parallel with, but not connected at all, with an entire conversation that we're having about how to reduce racial and ethnic disparities in healthcare access or healthcare procedures and outcomes. Clearly, there seems to be some difference here. We're putting a lot of responsibility, quote, on patients who are Medicaid, who are the poor, and at the same time, the whole discussion about disparities, which I'm sure Kaiser is a whole other group, is talking about how to make providers and health plans more responsible for the outcomes of those who are of racial or ethnic minorities. So it seems to me there may be an opportunity here to bring these two conversations together in at least some way. I mean, it strikes me, and I'm involved right now in an evaluation of the National Health Plan Collaborative to reduce ethnic and racial disparities in health, and you've got the big national health plans involved in these conversations. Not sure how much they're doing quite yet, but at least they're involved in these conversations. And if these are the folks that we're expecting to take care of Medicaid recipients who are in these plans, then clearly, you know, these two conversations need to come together. Any comments? Do you know of any states that are sort of putting these a little more closely together?
Well, I think in terms of health disparities, there are a number of states that are looking at that, particularly when you look at chronic illness and you look at who are the diabetics and who has hypertension and who has kidney failure, a lot of them are racial and ethnic minorities. And the question is, how do you, and asthma would be another area. And I think that probably states have some of the best data in terms of where the disease goes, how it begins, how it goes out with people that have been on the Medicaid program for some time. So I think that there's an opportunity for private sector and Medicaid to collaborate on ways to improve treatment for people with those illnesses. And if there are differences in the treatment between racial and ethnic minorities and others who have those conditions, you know, where those things are, I mean, that would require some collaboration with Medicaid, the private plans and researchers to take a look at those things. And I believe some of that's being done. I don't know that it's very large scale, but I think for the first time, now that we're focusing on chronic illness and people with multiple chronic illnesses as a focal group, that presents an opportunity to do some more collaboration on how to best treat those people and get them back in the workforce to the extent that that's possible, which I think is one of the areas of focus. These are people who are working age people to a high degree who are not able to function in the workplace because of their illnesses, and what can we do to address that and help them, you know, support their families. So I think there's some opportunities there.
Robin, did you want to?
I think that there are some opportunities there, and it would be great if those two things could come together, but I fear that a lot of the discussion about personal responsibility on the Medicaid side and in the context of the DRA and these waivers are forcing individuals to be even a little bit more disconnected with providers and the healthcare system, because some of the things that are coming up in personal responsibility are increased cost sharing, which again create barriers to
individuals seeking care because of cost. And there's navigating through plans and choices, again, will make it a little bit more difficult for beneficiaries to get the services that they need. So I think it would be great if those things can come together, but I fear that a lot of the discussion is not promoting that activity.
I think we have time for one more question from the audience. The lady up here in blue.
Good morning.
Here's a mic coming your way.
Thanks. I'm Linda Bregovsky from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. And it seems to me that women, as the key decision makers around health care for their families, are disproportionately affected by all policy related to health care, not just DRA. And all of you have, in some way, mentioned health literacy as an issue, a barrier that we need to overcome. I would like some, on behalf of the department, what can we do? I mean, there's been a lot of talk around it. Everybody acknowledges it's an issue. But how do we really make inroads? It's not just about pregnant women seeking care. It's about women as caregivers helping their older mothers decide, do I want to age in place? Do I want to go in a nursing home? It's about moms of disabled children deciding, how do I select a medical home for my severely disabled child so that they can remain in our home? It's women across the lifespan facing major responsibility for making health decisions. How do we empower them, educate them, reward them, give them feedback, give them empowerment? And on behalf of the Woodlawn class of 72, I want to say hello to Jackie Judd, who was a year ahead of me in high school. I'm sorry if I gave it away.
You surprised me, and you did.
Helena.
Wow, she's surprised. I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, in terms of women's role, just kind of navigating the health system for their whole families. And, I do think that there is an important role for the healthcare providers as well to kind of at least initiate and start some discussions and give women some guidance. I think we all have responsibility. I think, women's magazines, media. I mean, I think that there's a lot that we can do to help people kind of start thinking about and learning resources. One of the things that we found in our women's health survey is that, half of women, when they go to their doctor, they don't get asked about exercise, about smoking. When you talk about STDs and HIVs, it's like in the teens. I mean, it's very low in terms of any initiation on important health issues that happens in the healthcare setting. On the other side, when we asked women, where's your most trusted source of information when you need healthcare? It's not the internet. It's not their friends. They say it's their healthcare providers. So clearly, I think that there is, this is where people are looking for information. And it's really tough because right now we don't really pay providers to do this. There's less and less time within a medical visit to even do those kinds of things. And, a lot of healthcare providers would argue, is that their job to also be health educators when they have so much else going on? So I think that, as the kind of healthcare decision makers, women are they're in a very difficult position. And when you talk about the Medicaid population, this is a population in many cases that faces a lot of disadvantages. And so it's even harder for them to get information, to get, transportation, to go to the doctor, and all of those things that we need to do.
Janet?
One of the things that we're struggling with is we hear so much from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services that the provider is the client of the government and not the recipient of the services, not the Medicaid or the Medicare beneficiary. I think the department really has to redirect its thinking about who it's responsible to, and ultimately for people in nursing homes, it is the residents. The Medicaid program was not developed to serve providers. It was developed to serve the people that it was developed to serve, the people who need long-term care. And we're hearing so much, and if you pick up the June Ladies Home Journal, there's an article about this, of families of nursing home residents who are, when they complain too much about the care and insist on good care, are told being told they can no longer visit the nursing home. The government has to be more of an advocate for families who are advocating on behalf of their family members. We just got calls all the time from daughters of nursing home residents and sons who are saying, you know, these things are happening to my mother, and I can't do anything about it. There is just nowhere in the system that I can get this addressed. And we see people dying from neglect because their families can't get these issues addressed before the resident dies.
Joy, final word.
I think that as a nation, we just don't put enough emphasis on being healthy, and that it's not a priority. And if it was, I mean, it's going to take multiple systems. It has to be TV. It has to be radio. It has to be Hollywood. It has to be communities. You can't depend on the Department of Health and Human Services to get that job done. It has to be schools talking to kids about healthy living, about insurance. I mean, you don't learn about insurance till you get out of high school and get a job. And they give you a form if they cover insurance. I mean, we can't go on in that way and then expect people to be health literate. And we have to put some importance on that topic as a nation and do multiple efforts. All advocacy groups have to be responsive to their members and help their members navigate our terribly complex system to do the best they can. So I think there's no one place to make that happen, but we all are responsible to be helpful in that way and to help our friends and neighbors as much as we can to get the information they need to be consumers in the healthcare market, which I think is one of the most complex. You think buying a car is hard. Nothing compared to navigating our healthcare system to get the simplest service.
Great. Sheila wants to say a final word, just a personal thank you from me. I know your dance cards get filled up really fast, so we're glad you're here.
In thanking all of our panelists today, our terrific moderator, I think Joy has left us with exactly the right message, which is this is an extraordinarily important topic, one that is often forgotten and often discussed in far too small a circle, and it is incumbent upon all of us, I think, to get engaged in this conversation, to become advocates, to, in fact, help people think about the implications of some of the changes that are in place and those that are being suggested, and the impact those will have on the women that we all care so deeply about. So I am very grateful that all of you are here this morning and very grateful to our panel for such a terrific conversation. Thank you very much.